Welcome to Brave. Be inspired by the best leaders of Southeast Asia tech. Build the future, learn from our past, and stay human in between. I'm Jeremy Au, a VC, founder, and father. Join us for transcripts, analysis, and community at www.jeremyau.com. Hey, Esmo, so excited to have you on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me here, Jeremy. It's so good to be able to speak to you again, even though we're both in different parts of the world.
Yeah, it's been so many years since Harvard Business School doing our MBA program and chilling and chatting about Southeast Asia. So I'm so excited to share your journey, obviously from Malaysia to Petronas to Harvard MBA to being a VC in SF, investing in climate and deep tech and saving the world. So really excited to talk about it.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. This is going to be a very fun conversation, just like old friends catching up. And that's what we're going to do here.
So Esmo, for those who don't know you yet, how would you share about yourself?
Yeah, I grew up in Malaysia. I was born in like the smallest state in Malaysia, in a fishing village. State literally is known for fishery department industry and also in the middle of paddy fields, amazing landscape. I enjoy my childhood just thinking about growing up there. But I also went to two different boarding schools that gave me exposure on academic excellence and thinking about like broadly what I can do with my life. And like any other Malaysian that grew up, the choices I have is either to become an engineer, a doctor, or an accountant, although I wanted to actually become a lawyer. But I was lucky enough to actually won a scholarship from Petronas, and they sent me to study mechanical engineering in the UK. And that's sort of like the start of my journey with Petronas. So I spent 4 years studying mechanical engineering in the University in Glasgow. I went back to Malaysia to serve with Petronas, and then I really started my career as a project engineer. One of the most exciting things about my early days in Korea is just going to fabrication yard and sort of like managing or just watching the construction of this big oil and gas infrastructure. And a lot of people take it for granted, like, you know, how your house being powered, the source of fossil fuel. And I was there sort of like in the yard, managing, overseeing the development of this mega project. And that gives you like appreciation of how complex the energy industry is, especially in Malaysia and also pretty around the world. Quickly after that, I sort of realized that my interest lies beyond engineering. I started to dabble into more technology development, commercial strategy, and sort of like more general management. And that sort of like pushed me to think about like what else can I do? So like as an engineer, how do I want to grow myself? So at some point in my career, I start thinking about postgraduate studies. So naturally researching MBA programs and thinking about what are the best schools, what program I want to grow. And I was lucky enough to be accepted to Harvard, and we were in the same class, 2017. And that was like 2 years of very transformative experience for me, because it sort of like gave me a broader perspective of like the different industries. I want to sort of like be candid about when you're working in oil and gas industry, and it's such a big industry, it's easy to get lost in like the complexity of industry, and you forget about every other interesting sector. So I think taking that break from work for 2 years at HBS, sitting in a classroom with 90 people from different background industries, give you a, like a real appreciation of what else is going out there. So my 2 years at HBS was really about more experimentation with like what I want to do. I spent a lot of my classes around entrepreneurship, strategy and operation. And after graduation, I went back to Petronas actually, because they also graciously decided to pay for my MBA and part of the deal just to go back and serve with them. And through that, I was sort of like given this opportunity to lead an internal project to set up the corporate venture arm of Petronas. Sort of like in a long-winded kind of way, that's sort of like how I got into the VC space, like from setting up the Petronas venture team in KL in late 2017, doing fund-to-fund investment, thinking about the broader strategy of how VC investment can help companies like Petronas pivot into more attractive industries, managing energy transition. And then finally, to sort of like spinning out a fund out of that initiative to co-founding a fund in Silicon Valley called Piva Capital, where we directly invest in breakthrough energy and industrial company. So this happened sort of like in 2019 before climate tech sort of like get the attention that it got during COVID. I'm glad there's a lot more interest in that space, But sort of like as a call out, we've been doing this sort of like even before that become a hype or become a hot area in VC investment. So excited to see a lot more people paying attention in this space because it's such an underrepresented or underinvested segment within the tech sector by VC capital.
Amazing. You shared about the start, about growing up in a place known for fishing in Malaysia. What was that like?
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, like, I try to compare my childhood. I don't have any kids. I'm not married. So I have a lot. I have nieces, nephews, I have friends with kids, right? And just like, try to think about the difference between my childhood and their childhood in big cities. I could go out with my friends and camping and hiking and trekking. Although my mom and dad would probably be worried sick about potential getting into accident, those kind of things. But I think the aspect of freedom of adventure, I think there's always that sense of adventure, like going out, trying new things. You fall down, you pick up yourself, you're sort of like not scared of things. And I thought that was sort of like the essence of my childhood. And sort of like when I think about a lot of the things I get to do since then, it's because I have very adventurous childhood. I'm sort of like more willing to take risks. I'm more willing to try new things. Obviously, I've lived in Malaysia, I live in Glasgow, I've been in London, I've been in Boston, I'm living in San Francisco now. So there's that spirit of adventure is sort of like something that I bring with me, I guess. And it's also good growing up when you don't have telephone or social media, right? Because you have to interact with people. You cannot interact through lights and comments, and you actually have to go out, make friends. And I think that social behavior is really important for kids growing up.
Yeah, definitely. And how did you get from that spot, which is, you know, not a place known for A or B or C? Was there any key moments that helped you change your trajectory of where you were going to go?
From childhood, well, interestingly enough, I think my mom and dad are the one that sort of like the driving force for my value in education and knowledge. I think from the very young age, for example, my mom buy English newspapers for us and sort of like start making us read English newspapers since I was like 6 years old. And then the thirst for knowledge, my mom and dad was very, very focused on that. All of my brothers end up in boarding school. I did national boarding school, state boarding school. There's a real appreciation for knowledge. There's a real appreciation for just the pursuit of knowledge in itself and also what else can it sort of like opportunity can unlock. And then throughout my journey, I've met great mentors who were like, hey, although you're from Perlis, which is like the smallest state in Malaysia, I've known these people who are successful doctors. Like, why don't you talk to these people? Or like successful engineers who are like, why don't you shadow these people for like, you know, a week or two to sort of like think about or rather learn what they can do. And then I have uncles and aunts who are like in different profession, in academic profession. They were also like a very good sounding board. And I grew up in a family that doesn't say no to me, like in the sense that if I want to pursue or learn about something, there's always willingness to share resources. I think that's important to unlock the imagination. And then from the moment I finished my high school in College Tunku Jaafar, finished my A-levels, I went to the UK, and that's sort of like the world sort of like my playground. From that, it's a lot more bigger place I can find myself to be in a way.
What was it like leaving Malaysia and entering the UK? What did you feel change in your life outlook?
I have one funny story I want to tell you. I think I was about maybe 19. I can't remember exactly how old I was. I arrived one day earlier than I was supposed to arrive. And the person who was supposed to pick me up at the Heathrow Airport forgot. Well, he got the date mixed. So he was not there. Flight landed at 4 a.m. I have to sort of like, alone, 4 a.m., Heathrow. Okay, fine. I'll wait for him. And then I have to call his office at 8 a.m. because that's when he actually got into his office. This is before we have handphones and everything else. Like, this is like years before social media exists. And then he told me to take the Heathrow Express to Piccadilly, which I did. Easy enough. But when I was waiting for him in Piccadilly, I heard this makcik, this auntie, sort of like scolding her daughter in Malay, in London. And I was thinking to myself, like, am I still in Kuala Lumpur? Why am I hearing this auntie speaking Malay in London? I was just like, it was such a mind-boggling sort of like situation because I was like, I'm in London. Why am I hearing people speaking Malay here? Just like, it doesn't make sense. And then London is like one of the most popular destinations for a lot of Malaysians. And if you go to Bayswater, actually, if they know that you are from Malaysia or you can speak Malay, a lot of people can actually speak Malay. So in a way, it's sort of like a good moment to remind myself that like, I'm so far away from Malaysia, but Malaysia will always be with me kind of way. That will follow me. And it's true, right? When you think about it, especially now, because the world has become so much more international, so more global. There's always people from your country or from your background that always feel like at home. So that's sort of like a trippy experience for me, but it was a fun experience as well, because obviously similar with you, when you went to Berkeley, right? So that experience of finding yourself, building that friendship that still lasts. People I went to boarding school with and we went to UK together. These are my friends that I've known each other for 20 years and we sort of like celebrate each other's birthday and those kind of things. So it's definitely, it was a challenge at the beginning, but I feel like because I was so excited to actually find my own identity. It becomes more like an adventure. This is incredible. Not a lot of people have this opportunity. I'm going to make the most out of it.
I guess aunties is the rallying cry of home, I guess.
Yeah.
So funny. And so there you are, and obviously you're studying. And what's interesting is that you study to be an engineer.
Yeah.
And you joined Petronas, right?
Yeah.
So very Malaysian, I would say.
Yeah.
Was that because it was the default? Is that why you chose to do it that way? Because I've heard that story quite a few times.
Yeah.
Or was it more like you felt like there's an intentional choice? How did it happen? Yeah.
There's a few dimensions to this story. I think I have a lot of friends who were Petronas scholars, decided to stay in UK and they joined different firms. I was actually working for KPMG in 2008 after graduation. I was, and if you recall, 2008 is like when the financial crisis happened. I was working for KPMG doing sort of like financial consulting, financial service for them. And it's not a field that I think as an engineer was like naturally something that I can do, but I really enjoy the work. But because the financial industry was sort of like going through this apocalypse, and then I was like, I don't know what's going to happen to me. A lot of my friends in Tokio Marine, Nomura was like got laid off, you know, within 24 hours notice, they have to vacate the office and things like that. I was like, I'm not sure whether this is going to impact me, but there was sort of like this uncertainty around security of the job, given that I just graduated. So I went back to Malaysia and Petronas offered me a position. Petronas will never guarantee a position, even to its own scholar. So you still have to go through like the process and everything. So they offered me a position. And I was like, great. I'm like, I can look for a new job. The economy market is not doing good. And then, or I can take Petronas offer and start think about, it's a good company. If you want to go back to Malaysia, it's one of the biggest company in Malaysia, if not in the world. It's a good gig as an engineer because you get thrown into sort of like the deep end of things and you get to learn very quickly. And that's what happened. I think like the first 3 years I really enjoyed because I was in a department that does mostly project management. And by that, I get to see how a prospect get evaluated and sort of like then people decide how many wells to drill, what sort of facilities they want to install, and then sort of like what's the operating philosophy around it and what sort of like what economics of an asset. And then I get to go on the site to see the construction of that facilities. I get to go offshore to see the works happening offshore, that all the appreciation. And that really sort of like give me beyond just as a mechanical engineer, beyond rotating equipment, or beyond a turbine or beyond an engine, I get to see how the sort of like the industry work. And that in part is what sort of like inspired me to think about, I can do so much more than become an engineer. What else can I do? And sort of like start looking for that opportunity. And then obviously working with Petronas, there's a lot of great leaders in the companies. And having a mentor and people who have gone through it and sort of like taking me under their wing, I think that's sort of like another moment in my career where I sort of like I have a lot of support and care by my mentor that allow me to be where I am today.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that, you know, you take on multiple different roles because you start out as an engineer.
Yeah.
And then you start drifting into what I call the dark side of the business side. The non-production side. Anyway, so tell us more about what did you discover? Why did you discover that, you know, you study engineering?
Yeah.
You did that, you started out with that, and then you drifted towards the business side. How did that self-realization happen?
I saw that I went back and forth. So by by sort of like more of like an opportunity, my head of department was looking for like a chief of staff. And it was like, hey, like I'm looking for a chief of staff. I'm busy. I need someone to like help me through all this thing. It's a very technical department. So they needed like an engineer to sort of like come and do that. So that's sort of like the first step of like general management route that I went to. It's more of like through it that we make, which is like, I really wanted to work offshore. And I felt like, you know, I want to become either like a reservoir engineer offshore doing like actual technical work. And he's my head of department. I'm just like, yeah, like I'll let you go and do this, but you come and sort of like serve my team of stuff for a few months or for a year and a half or something like that, which I did. I really enjoy it. I like the exposure of like general management, strategy and those kind of stuff. And then I did actually go and do the offshore work. And then I spent about 12, 18 months sort of like developing a sort of like a reservoir, modeling everything. And my day is, as much as it is interesting, but I'm still mostly spending my days in front of my supercomputer doing my simulation. It feels like I can do more than this kind of like moment, right? It's just like, this is an important job for someone who really like to do this and don't want to interact with people. But I sort of like, I still need to have that interaction with people, some sort of like broader discussion around strategy, around commercial. So I kind of like quickly, I realized that as much as I thought I wanted to become an engineer, I don't want to spend the rest of my career in sort of like a very technical specialized role. So then I sort of like go back to do strategy development for the corporate strategy planning unit within one of the division Petronas. And through that work, I get to work with companies like Exxon, Shell, all these big oil and gas players. I get to work on commercial projects like designing the fiscal terms for awards of new contracts and then work with industry players in Malaysia about like developing the service industry of oil and gas in Malaysia. So it's a really sort of like multi-discipline, multi-domain kind of like projects that I really enjoy. And it's like internal consulting, right? So like you sort of like you work on a case and you move on from case to case. And I find that a lot more engaging and more challenging because you're always learning something new every day.
Wow, that's one heck of a journey and learning experience. And you decide to cap it all off by going to do a Harvard MBA where you meet me. So what was your decision to make do a Harvard MBA? That's where you like get thrown your lot with the dark side.
This is another thing that I don't really tell a lot of people about this, but I have a good friend who is a doctor and we both study in the UK together. And then there's this one moment in our life where we're just going through a lot of ups and downs and we were watching a movie called Legally Blonde. Both of us were just like, if Al Wood can make it to Harvard Law School, like what's stopping us from like applying to, you know, this prestigious school? So my friend, who's a doctor, is going to Oxford to do his next step in his qualification as a neurosurgeon. And I end up sort of like applying to a bunch of business school. And the road is not as straightforward as people think, because there's a lot of research, like understanding what school fit, what you're looking out for, what program you need to understand, and then sort of like what value after graduation, those kind of things. So for me, there's always that sort of like dream of like, hey, I want to go to Harvard. Kind of like, I don't care what school it is in the first place, and to sort of like educating myself or like what the program is and all that thing. And I think you and me can probably sort of like agree on this. I think the key study method sort of like the reason why I felt like it's such a special learning environment. There's so many times that I was sort of like watching the key study method on YouTube while doing other things, just because I feel like so inspired by all this conversation, interaction, things like that, right? And I went to visit the school. It did not disappoint, which I think was so important, because sometimes you have a different idea of what that school can be and like when in person is different. But yeah, I mean, like it sort of like exceed every all expectation that I had. And I think that was a very conscious decision for me to sort of like take a pause, go back to school and sort of like push the limit of my comfort zone, do different things, get to know different people, and then sort of like kind of think about like what I want to do post MBA.
Well, I love the Legally Blonde story there for sure. Well, for me, your social network.
For you, social network. No, I was going to say like Edward's a real inspiration for all of us.
Yeah, I know. Why would you not? I mean, I thought it was a really funny movie as well.
Yeah.
So I guess what was your key takeaways from the Harvard MBA program? Like, what did you feel your experience was like?
So the thing that I saw like really appreciative now is given I made a switch into VCU. And I feel like HBS network is such a sort of like a very, very supportive network. They're always our classmates who are like in VC or in PE. They're always willing to share. And this goes beyond relationship or things that you learn in class. So there's that. And that is because I think the way the curriculum is designed is that, you know, the first year we spend intense 2 semesters with 90 people and sort of like talking about a lot of different things. And that really pushes to know each other. And then sort of like that trust that developed in the section experience. I really appreciate it because I have a lot of things I'm learning and I'm going to be completely candid. You know, there are things that I do not know, right, about VC, about things. And I can just sort of like ask this because it created the safe environment. I think that's all the magic of just the section experience and how people can sort of like bond and develop that trust. And then the professors are amazing as well. Some of the underrated professors and the things that I remember like in my second year, our EC year, I want to say like 90% of my classes were all from AdDrop. And it's all because you sit down in the class and you sort of like, oh, this professor is amazing. And then you saw like the vibe of the class is so good and you just really enjoy it. It sort of like made me think about, it's not so much something that HBS sort of like talk about. I guess there are marquee professor that they sort of like they marketed, right? Like all these great professors, which are great. But they are also like really good underrated professor that seriously change the way you think about business or everything else. The thing I really, really appreciate about HBS, it's probably some of the late nights conversation that we have in the dorm. For example, you order food from, what's the name of the restaurant again in Cambridge? I can't remember.
Spangler. Oh, Royal East. The Southeast Asia party is also thing.
Royal East. Yeah. Shout out to Auntie Carrot, if I'm mistaken, that's her name.
Yeah.
She's from Kuching, Malaysia. And then, I'm like, those kind of like, just like small group gathering, different section, but people who reach out to you, who really want to know about you or learn about you. And so like, then you get to know them. And all this sort of like mini conversation that you have are very meaningful, very real, and sort of like help develop that relationship, right? And then sort of like, and this is like the people that you know for like a few weeks and then you get to be best friends. It's because of that genuine connection that you build throughout this, right? So I guess my answer is a combination of both, like the academic is excellence, but also the people, the quality of people that you meet is just amazing as well.
Yeah, that's all the best parts. And when you left Harvard, then you went back for a bit, right? So talk about that. So at Harvard MBA, you suddenly decided along the way that you wanted to, and then we're talking a little bit about it. You were talking a little bit about going back to Petronas and what was beyond that. And I think that's where we left off. And I remember my pleasant surprise when we were catching up and you were like, oh, I'm VC now. And I was like, oh, okay. So walk us through that, like that self-reflection, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, going back is obviously a choice. And I appreciate Petronas for all the opportunities they've given me. And I think my thought process was around like, I know I don't want to be in a traditional oil and gas energy industry anymore. There's a lot of things that we can do. We get exposed to a lot of different innovation. So I can either go and sort of like join other firms and sort of be part of that exciting industry directly. Or I can sort of like go back to Petronas and sort of like become a change agent internally to advocate for them to do something different. In my conversation with my mentors, with the people in the company, they gave me an offer that's sort of like hard for me to refuse because I went back, I joined the office of the group CEO and president of the company. And to be sort of like in the office where you have a direct access to the CEO, you know what's going on with the company, and sort of like your input matters to the direction of the company. Sort of like, you know, it's a very interesting, compelling value proposition. It's a small office, and so like at one point there's only like 5-8 people working closely with the CEO. And that was sort of like the thing that won me over. Just like, if I want to go back, I want to go back and want to be able to make an impact. I also remember that was the time. So before I left, 2014 was the big oil crisis this is like the last one before COVID. And that was the time where a lot of majors, like rationalizing the portfolios and thinking about like what else can they do, how can they protect against disruption and those kind of things. And then ride sharing sort of like become big and people are seeing Grab, Uber everywhere. And so like traditional energy companies sort of like asking themselves like, are we under threat? What's going to happen? Blah, blah, blah. True to sort of like big industry, big company, you know, it takes them a few years to think about it. So I left in 2015. We were talking about that implication. I came back in 2017. They were like just about ready to sort of like embrace new way of doing things. So I was sort of like in this very, very fortunate position where I had an overview of what the company is looking at. I can pick sort of like project I want to work on. And then one of my mentor in the company is given the responsibility to think about investing in technology. So I approached him and said like, hey, look, you know, there's a few ways to invest in technology. We can do this, 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 with the intention of setting up the corporate VC of Petronas. Petronas, since its inception in 1974, never had a corporate VC arm. It does a lot of internal R&D. It has a big R&D center in Malaysia and a few others around the world. I think they have like 6-7 around the world. And they have a lot of collaboration with renowned universities in the UK, in China and whatnot. But for some reason, they have always been reluctant to sort of like embrace venture capital as sort of like a source of new innovation. So for me, it's just like, you know, it's perfect, right? Because like, this is the segment that I think is going to be disrupted. I have the technical background behind it. Harvard gave me this exposure around innovation, entrepreneurship, financial management kind of thing. I can make use of my investment strategy class finally. So like, hey, there's some value of it. So that was sort of like an interesting time to be in the company because I get to be in the driver's seat with two other of my colleagues in Petronas who are working with us to like try to formulate this thing. So we started the project, I would say like in October of 2017. And so like we pushed through and we got it approved by 2017. So we did it in a sort of like a very fast pace. We got the management team excited about it. And they were like, okay, we should do this. This is like a way to get new innovation. And then it's like a few months after that, they announced that formation of Petronas Ventures and Petronas sort of like looking into startups and, you know, inviting innovation and all that thing. And then tangential to that was that a lot of learnings from corporate VC. Corporate VC has a very bad reputation, especially from a big energy, oil and gas. Very cyclical in the sense that when the market is doing well, they have a lot of money to spend, they invest in a lot of companies. And then when the market is not doing well, they pull back, right? Because they don't have the budget for it, which is, when you think about it, when the companies are doing well is when you need to invest in technology, because that's sort of like how you future-proof your revenue. So we were conscious about like not making the mistake that other CVC have done in the past. So there's a lot of learnings, there's a lot of books written about CVC in the last 20, 30 years. And that sort of like got us to this realization that if we want to have a closer interaction with innovation in Silicon Valley, we need to have a presence in Silicon Valley. We need to have people who have the network and capability to make those investments without having to go back to corporate office to sort of like seek permission and whatnot, right? So long story short, then it's sort of like that's the genesis of like how we think about, okay, we need to create a separate independent fund. Petronas is the limited partner of this fund and they still have all the rights in terms of setting up the fund strategy, area of interest and those kind of things. But essentially, after we define the fund purpose, we want to let experienced venture capitalists in Silicon Valley that has experience investing in energy industrial to run the fund independently, because then we can sort of like make the bet for in the future innovation, things like that. So through all of that work, I was the one sort of like putting our together. I came together with my co-founder who used to be the managing director of GE Ventures, Ricardo Angel. And we sort of like come together. We formed a super team to think about the fund. And then we closed the fund, proper LPA, signed off by Petronas, everything in mid of 2019. And then I sort of like started to make my transition from Kuala Lumpur to San Francisco. And lucky me, I moved just before COVID hit the entire world, right? So this is where I've been for the last almost 2 years, sort of like stuck in San Francisco and then having the time of my life, actually.
Wow, what a journey. And you know, what's interesting is that now you're not just being VC in you know, more energy, but really the future of energy, right? About climate tech and future of work and the future of industry. So talk us more about that. What's the thinking behind that? You know, why not just invest in more coal and oil and gas, drilling technology? I mean, there's still a lot of opportunity. I mean, so what's the thinking behind that? Yeah.
When we set up Piva Capital as a fund, we think about the future in three buckets. What else? What are the enabling technology that can make our existing operation cheaper, greener, more efficient, increase productivity and those kind of things? And that's sort of like the thinking around that with the digitization industry. It should apply to broadly across industries, not just oil and gas, mining, extraction. It could be manufacturing, it could be everything else. So the idea of sort of like cleaning up this dirty industry. And then the second idea is what we think about, if we want to reduce our dependency on petroleum, we have to find new ways of producing materials. So that's why we think about future materials in production, novel chemistry, advanced materials, new production techniques and those kind of things. So the world is addicted to not just cheap energy from coal or natural gas. When you think about it, everything around you, almost everything around you is actually made from petroleum. So it's like crazy. There's like some stats around there, like your EV might be powered by electricity, but your car, 80% of it is actually made from petroleum. So those are the things that if you think about climate change, there's a lot of other implications that's beyond the consumption of energy that we have to think about. And then the third one, just thinking about future of energy and mobility. The reason why I think this is more for our investor is Petronas, and they are an energy company. So they've sort of like rebranded themselves as an energy company recently, and they announced net zero last year. So in that sense, they really need to get new innovation around renewables, energy storage, battery technology. So my logic to that is that the company has billions of CapEx that's spent on existing asset that can be funneled into finding petroleum if they want to. But then the venture capital is really at the edge of innovation. So we want to find who is producing the next battery that can replace lithium ion, who is producing the next fusion reactor, right, that can make energy accessible for all. So that is really where we think the money should be spent when it comes to just being at the edge of innovation. The good thing is that in the last 18 months, there's a lot of interest around climate tech because people start to realize that we only have one planet. Everything that we do has climate impact. So what can we do today to mitigate the impact so that our future generation still have one planet to live in? So like, you know, some people are now flying to Mars, which is good, but not all of us are billionaires that can fly to space, right? So we still have to figure out, like, for the rest of us who have to live on Earth, what can we do for a better future?
And what's interesting, of course, is that so much of your life has revolved around Petronas. I'm sure that when you first left university, you had no idea that you'd be spending over a decade with Petronas and all the different steps you had. On reflection, like, do you feel like, obviously, I'm sure you're grateful for Petronas, but how would you think about it today? Like, if someone was asking you today and say, hey, I'm a university student, I'm a fresh grad, I'm a young professional, and I'm thinking about joining Petronas, what advice would you give them to think about it, but also how to be best positioned to grow from it? Yeah.
On reflection, I would say, like, probably instead of thinking about, do I want to work with a company like Petronas, do a bit more research to think about, like, if you join Petronas, who's going to be your boss? Because I feel like in my career in Petronas, I was so fortunate because I have, like, great, superior mentors that sort of, like, become my sponsor in the company. People really make your career. It's not so much about the company. Company has amazing system to support your goals, ambition, processes in place, learning, opportunity, and those kind of things. But you don't interact with the company. You interact with the people around you. So like who your bosses are, who your peers are going to be. And then for a company like Petronas, they're layers of superiors. Your boss have their boss have their boss and things like that, right? So I think be conscious of like what does joining a big company like Petronas could look like and mean for you. I know that young people, perhaps they have a lot of energy and they want to make changes and they want to see changes happen very quickly, right? So then it's around, you know, if you join a company like Petronas and if you want to make quick changes, you might find yourself being in a very frustrating situation because there's a lot more inertia around changes. Having said that, I think even company like Petronas recognize that they have to change to attract the young talents. Credit is where credit due. There's a lot of initiative internally, so like to make it more attractive for young talents. They are trying to be more nimble. There's a lot of innovation happening in the space. The company is trying to explore beyond energy, like what else they can do. So it is an interesting time to be. If you are adventurous, if you are ambitious and you want to be part of this journey, that could be like the question that you should be asking yourself and people who interview you about a position in Petronas. Like, how does that sort of like overlap with your interests?
Amazing. That's such great advice. Wrapping things up here, could you tell us about a time that you have been brave?
I want to say like walking around the street of San Francisco during COVID. I'm just joking. That's probably, you know, everybody have that experience. One of my brother was diagnosed with cancer when he was 22 years old. And so like having gone through this question about mortality at a very young age and sort of like being able to process grief, I think that's the kind of bravery that until now I reflect and say like, it took me a while to admit that I need help to process grief. What does it mean to me having lost a brother at a very young age? A cancer and sort of like all these other issues, and not be afraid, go and seek help. We're young, especially Asian, have this very bad taboo around like mental health kind of thing, right? So we don't want to admit that we're struggling or we start grieving. There was a situation where I actually broke down in front of an interviewer that sort of like made me realize that I really need to get help. And so like that admission to myself, admission to my interviewer about like the things that I've gone through in my personal life about the death of my brother that I need to process properly. And it was my brief moment of admitting to myself that I need help.
Wow, that's so rough. And I'm proud of you that you did that, got help. I think I shared with you, my first girlfriend passed away in high school. So I was grieving. I crashed out of high school. It took me a long, long, long while to even acknowledge that I was grieving, which kind of sucked in retrospect. So I totally know what it's like to not want to get help because you don't even know that you should get help. That's a tough moment, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of weird, right? Because we're all going to die one day, right?
When you're younger, you don't think about dying, right? Yeah. And sort of like trip you a bit. And then obviously young people also die.
Yeah.
You just have to talk like, how do you process all that thing?
Right. And what's funny is because when you're young and someone dies, like the biggest thing on earth. One thing I realized as I get older is everybody understands that grief because everybody has had a friend or family member die as well. So I remember as a young kid, a teenager, and I'm like, all these old people are saying like, oh, I understand. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. I guess I understand why you understand, because even though it's not necessarily your girlfriend who passed away, it's your mom, or your aunt, your best friend. So what advice would you give for people who are processing with grief? How would you advise them to get help or think about it?
It's a funny thing because one of my most meaningful conversations I had with my dad, actually, which kind of showed that the best people to understand, especially if you lose someone close to you, is probably your family members. There are a lot more mental health startups at the moment. Like that's sort of like very great resources that's available. So just reach out to those people and sort of like schedule something. You're not forced to talk about it, but at least if you want to, know that there's always resources for you to be able to talk to people. And these are amazing resources that are available to you. And it's just a matter of finding that, I guess, like, you know, the first step of making that call or reaching out to people, something that you probably have to wrestle more with yourself.
Wow, that was deep. I agree. Getting help anywhere is better than not getting help from anywhere. On that note, Esma, I would love to like paraphrase the three big themes I heard from this conversation, discussion. The first, of course, was thank you so much about sharing what was it like to grow up in a smaller state of Malaysia and how you learned the influence of your parents, the inflection points where you made a decision at each point to keep going and keep growing. And I think that's an amazing journey from not just to boarding school, to being an engineer, to Petronas, to learning business, to do a Harvard MBA, and then to Petronas again and in a different role, and to VC, investing in the future of energy, climate, and deep tech. And I think the second thing, of course, is thank you so much for really sharing, I think, the insider story of someone who grew up in Malaysia, Petronas. I love the dynamics there because not just Petronas, but lots of other government-linked companies have a similar dynamic as well. In Malaysia, in Singapore, in Thailand, in Indonesia, Vietnam, Philippines, there's lots of companies that have a similar dynamic. I think what the advice you gave is not just true for Petronas, but also true for many folks in different situations. And of course, the third thing is, I think we just scratched the surface of it, but thank you so much for sharing about processing grief and thinking about how that is a deeper understanding and a deeper layer of work that needs to be done. And I think bravery seems like these big things that you have done. You have done these things like Legally Blonde and Harvard MBA. You have done MBA Chief of Staff. But I think what I really appreciated was that the bravest thing that you did was actually getting help for your own grief and helping you process that into who you are today.
That's a perfect summary. Thanks, Jeremy.
Thanks, Esmo. Thank you for listening to Brave. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share this episode with friends and colleagues. Sign up at www.jeremyau.com to discuss this episode with other community members in our forum. Stay well and stay brave.